The Paunch Stevenson Show. PaunchStevenson.com. Episode 316. Friday, August 15th, 2025.
Welcome to the Paunch Stevenson Show.
We're here. The Paunch Stevenson Show has come back from a very long hiatus. We are not dead. We have not been sent by the ICE to Venezuela to some kind of prison camp yet. But we are here. I am on the road somewhere in Pennsylvania, and I have two guests. I have Mark Doubt's Elite, the co-founder, triple founders, along with the great and powerful Lanza, Mr. Woodmo Dana.
What's up, guys?
And then we have, he's known as Weewan Flair. He'll have to explain where that name came from. Sean.
I mean, the name is something that will haunt me forever. But it really is the dumbest thing. It was when Ric Flair got fired by Eric Bischoff that time, and the fans would...
Was that kayfabe?
No, it was real. Huh. And then those were when he went to Reed's wrestling tournament instead of showing up. Because he had asked for a couple days off. They granted him the days off. They forgot they had granted him the days off. A pretty common thing for anyone with a job. He had gone to the tournament. And Bischoff said, "You cannot go. You have to come to Nitro." And he just went anyway. And so they fired him publicly. And then the fans would chant, "We want Flair, we want Flair," yeah. On Nitro for weeks. And he came back and they cut that old promo, "You are a no good son of a bitch," whatever. But I thought that was a funny thing. And so I randomly used that as a username for like one message board that I joined. And then, you know, when you have like a name and a password, you kind of stick to it. Yeah. And then here we are 25 years later. They're almost 30 years later.
30 years?
No, 28. That was 98, so, all right. 27 years later, yeah.
Close enough.
But wait, how long was Flair fired, though? Didn't seem like he was ever fired.
I mean, 2 months, maybe?
Oh.
Yeah. It was a big story at the time.
That was not when they put him in the ambulance and supposedly took him to the nut hut?
No. He was on the clock for all that.
Yeah, so, while I'm here, I just had a crimpet. I haven't had one of those in a long time. Dana actually knew what they were.
I did. If there's one thing I know, it's sweets.
I don't know what that is.
It's a tasty cake. Well, I ate them all, so you can't look at them. It's a tasty cake product. It's basically like a pound cake with like a little cream on it, and they're shaped like they're shaped kind of like an eight with like an eight if you put like another circle around it. I don't know. It's hard to explain. They go very well with like tea.
So like an offshoot of a crumpet? It's a crimpet?
Yeah, it's a crimpet.
Yeah.
You gotta know what a crumpet is before you can know cricket. No, nothing? No Ninja Turtle fans here? Fine. That was a famous line.
I'm terrible at lines.
The first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles movie, live action, when Raphael meets Casey Jones for the first time. You know where they shot that scene?
I have no idea.
No.
Right in front of what is now the Trump Hotel by Central Park, right by Columbus Circle.
I haven't seen that movie in at least 20 years.
That's blasphemy.
I agree.
Well, actually, you could see it in good faith because the April O'Neil that you antagonized with me and the other guy was in the second and third movies.
Was she drunk in those movies?
No, I think she was okay then.
Okay.
Wait, the first movie was Judith Hogue. The second one was
Paige Turco.
So wait, do we know why Judith Hogue didn't get picked up for the second movie? She was good in the first movie.
Yeah, the story's out there. I don't remember what it is specifically. I think it's honestly probably was money. They probably didn't want to pay her.
They want to pay her guarantee or big money.
Well, they had to spend for Vanilla Ice. And the great David Warner.
Well, listen, CM Showstopper's in favor of the Vanilla Ice.
Go Ninja, Go Ninja, Go.
That had its moment.
Did it?
I'm gonna be honest.
I will say, I gotta be honest with you. I'm not a, you know this. I'm not a rap fan. However, on the first Turtles album, there was the T-U-R-T-L-E Power rap song. I don't even remember. I couldn't even tell you who did it, but I actually liked it.
It spoke to you?
Well, it was. This was back in the day when rap was like an offshoot. It was like an offshoot of like dance kind of party music, just like kind of slower. That's when I liked it. And then when they started, you know, talking about women's privates and shooting people and everything, then I kind of tapped out.
I mean, speaking of women's privates, we got some great metallic
friends. There should be no solicitation on this show.
This is serious, so give me a quarter. I was a witness, get me a reporter. Call April O'Neill in on this case. Hey, you better hurry up, there's no time to waste. We need help, like quick on the double. Have pity on the city, man, it's in trouble. We need heroes like the Lone Ranger. When Tonto came pronto, when there was danger, they didn't say we'd be there in half an hour, cause they displayed turtle power.
So, all right, so we're out here in Pennsylvania. I'll explain why in a second, but you guys have started to do, for what, like a year now, the Marked Out official podcast. You know, whenever I had lands on one of these trips and we did a podcast, that was the Marked Out kind of podcast, but now you guys are actually doing it. Why?
I mean, that was my question for the first couple of months. I wasn't sure why.
I mean, I if I'm being candid, which why the heck
you
not?
You don't need to be.
I really know no other way to be. I find as a two-pronged reason. First, I find the hobby that we all engage in completely ridiculous, and I'm often filled with deep shame about doing it. And so this is sort of cathartic in that I get to confront some of the ridiculousness and some of the shame and make fun of myself and other people who are deserving of it and kind of blow off steam in that way. And also, you know, we started doing the Marked Out collectibles thing, selling stuff, and I find retail to be loathsome. I despise it. But it's a kind of a necessary evil in terms of our big plans.
It's a great promo.
You know, it's true. I'm being honest. I find retail to be loathsome. But I always thought that, you know, I'm a pretty bad retailer, but I'm a pretty decent communicator. And if we can somehow kind of merge the two and parlay the retail piece into a communications piece and make it interesting, I think there's so many untapped media potential in this hobby. You know, yesterday we were joking about a potential documentary for some of the freakish personalities in this hobby, and I think there's so much. There's so much untapped media potential for this, and none of it's been exploited. No. And I feel like maybe I'll luck into it somehow. So that's kind of why I'm doing it anyway.
Well, there is, you know, when Rob and I started doing this podcast in 2005, podcasting was completely different. It was like a very niche thing, and the only people really listening were other niche people that were interested in podcasts, usually other podcasters. So it wasn't much else going on. But now, like, every celebrity does a podcast, comedians do a podcast. And what has actually happened is, especially in this industry, if you will, the celebrity collectible, whatever, is that everyone does a podcast, but everybody else's is all, most of them are on, are like video streams and things like that. So it's like they're selling and doing a stream where they're talking about stuff, but it's like you can't separate the two. You're sitting there while these guys are hawking, you know, Don West style, and then they're covering some topics, but it's like, eh. And then they can, and like, you know, what you guys do that's, I think, I didn't realize you guys were actually going to do this, but you're kind of no holds bar in that you're just, you know, if you don't like something, you call it out. If you don't like somebody, you hammer them. I mean, none of these other people are ever going to do that because they're just business first, last, second, whatever.
I've said it on the show. I've said specifically, I don't care if I don't sell another item. in my life. I truly don't. And I know people may not believe me when I say that, but I am 100% sincere. If we sell nothing else ever again, I'm okay. This is not a meaningful part of my my life or my income. It's just sort of for fun. And also, you know, it's interesting and there's some potential or whatever. I'd much rather hammer people and, you know, and tell the truth. I can't, I don't have the energy to lie or hide.
No, I think hosting a podcast is a lot more interesting and fun than packing orders and, you know, dealing with cardboard and labels and all of that. I don't know if I'd say I'd be happy to sell nothing for the rest of my life. I'd like to, you know, I don't need a stack of Maria's vagina just like sitting around my house for the rest of my life. So I hope they sell, but I agree, I'm not going to walk on eggshells just to protect the sales.
Yeah, so we're in Pennsylvania. We got through most of Pennsylvania now, and I'm actually here, and I had some mints from a Mr. Rogers Encouragement.
You bought it?
Of course.
You stole it.
I stole it. I went to a Mr. Rogers exhibit and stole the mints.
There you go.
So. We went all the way out to Pittsburgh, went to the Steel City Convention. We've all been there before, blah, 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 blah. And then what I had said to these guys, and they're, you know, they were nice enough to take me along with them, was I really wanted to see this Heinz Museum Center, which was in downtown Pittsburgh, because they had a Mr. Rogers exhibit. And I'm an 80s child, although the man was on TV forever. But, you know, when I'm in my formative years, I was always watching Mr. Rogers, like, always. And so, you know, and one of the things I've done in this hobby is be able to meet, fortunately, some of these people that, you know, even if they were puppeteers or whatever, voice actors, you know, when you're a little kid, it's I always value that more than so many of those other celebrity encounters. And Rob and I have actually had some on the show. We talked to Larry Kenny for a while one time, for instance, and Alan Oppenheimer and several others that we saw at some of these conventions. So Mr. Rogers, we went to the exhibit. It's not a big exhibit in their museum. They have the treehouse, you know, with the little the birdhouse that the owl used to come out of, and they had the King Friday's castle, or at least part of it. I'm not sure if that was the entire castle originally. And then they also had a part of the set, which was the front of the house in his living room or whatever den, where the door would open, he would come down the steps, and they had the little box, the little thing set up with a little Mr. Rogers kind of mannequin where he's tying his shoes and some of the puppets. So in terms of, you know, if you're a Mr. Rogers fan, I guess, or a kid, it's probably the best experience you can have because he did the show in Pittsburgh, and I think there's some stuff at the actual Smithsonian, but beyond that, there's really not much, and they had a gift shop, so what do you guys think?
I'll be honest, when you first mentioned doing this, I was honestly humoring you at first by saying, oh, yeah, yeah. I honestly thought you would flip out when you heard you had to go to this museum, but I figured, you know, maybe the guests will cancel, we'll never end up going to Pittsburgh at all, so whatever, we'll just, you know, see what happens. And
wait, Dan, have you ever seen Mr. Rogers?
Of course. It was on in the 90s.
I was saying to Sean, I said, he's had to have seen
it. Yeah, I watched it religiously.
All right.
And as I said, in the museum, I think that was the highlight of my trip, which is actually kind of sad since I dropped the grand at Steel City. This was a $20 admission.
Yeah.
And another $100 in the gift shop.
Well, that's your choice.
Yes. But it was honestly the highlight. I got to touch the treehouse.
Yeah, that you can't do that in the museum. It's not show and tell.
You know, who's going to tell?
I was actually moved by it in a strange way. You know, this month has been weird in terms of losing childhood icons.
Yes, we'll cover some of those.
And I was seeing it, and they had this kind of a loop of Mr. Rogers' voice playing, and so I was a little bit moved by it. You know, Mr. Rogers, you know, was kind of, I mean, I am not going to say anything nuts, but he was an important part of my childhood in the sense that And I mentioned this to you guys there, that like people like Mr. Rogers are so rare. They don't really exist. And I'm not sure even conditions exist today where someone like Mr. Rogers could even exist. It was really, really cool, really, really moving. And, you know, Mr. Rogers is someone who was a real legend. I mean, if you haven't seen when he testified to the Senate in favor of PBS funding, it's a very, very famous clip, a very famous moment where Mr. Rogers convinces the Senate to fund PBS, which is obviously, you know, timely and newsworthy again today.
Yeah, they defunded it.
Yeah. And so it was an incredible. I used to use that clip from Mr. Rogers testifying to the Senate, to teach about rhetorical technique and speech technique, language technique, because it was so powerful. And he's an incredible human being, one of a kind, and to see some of that stuff, which seemed on TV to be so magical, and you see it in person. And it's just, you know, it's sort of withering away and behind glass. It was very moving. I'm very, very glad I did it.
Same.
Well, actually, the sets were not behind glass, were they?
No, the sets were not. That's how Dana was able to touch one.
Yes.
Miscreant.
Listen, I want to actually climb onto the actual set, which you guys talked me out of.
I had mentioned that. I was like, boy, wouldn't it be nice to, like, jumping? Like, well, you couldn't go through the door because the wall was behind it. But then I was thinking to myself, you know, if I go to jump on this, I'll probably go right through this plywood that they have
there. There was, like, a platform in front of it that wasn't actually...
That's my point.
You could have stood on that part.
Yeah, that didn't look solid either.
Well.
It's a museum. Well, one of the things that I noticed about it, and let me tell you, it's a very nice museum. And a very interesting museum in the sense that they had artifacts. Well, they had some sports stuff, obviously, the Steelers and the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Pirates. But there was a lot of artifacts there from the, you know, industrial manufacturing heritage of Pittsburgh. And just a lot of cultural stuff there that you would never really see at most museums. You know, they had like a Polish section, Italian section. For instance, some of the other ones I probably were there. I just didn't read the signs. And it was really, really weird. And then they had the first like floor we went through was all like 19th century like dress and toys and things like that. And I thought it was very interesting and different than what you would normally see. Oh, well, and plus there was the Heinz ketchup section, which actually wasn't that big because I thought that was kind of dumb.
Don't forget Napoleon.
Yes. So they had a bronze, I guess it was bronze, death mask of Napoleon sitting there. And I assume he died probably, I don't know, 300 years ago at this point. No. 1, 2, yeah, no. 18, help me out. 200 or 300? 200.
Yeah, 200.
Yes. 200 years ago, so that was interesting.
Listen, valid selfies were taken with Napoleon.
Not by me.
I thought that the museum very clearly exuded a love for the city of Pittsburgh, which made it interesting and fun, because how often do you see museums that are really devoted to a sort of celebration of a particular region? And this, right. this is Western Pennsylvania. That's what you're getting. You know, and I'm not from Western Pennsylvania in any way, but you can see very clearly see that's what they were documenting, that there was a love for that, and I like stuff like that.
Yeah, because if you think the big museum in Philadelphia is the Franklin Institute, and then New York obviously has a number of huge museums and things like that, and they're all, those were built largely in early part of the 20th century for the most part, things like that, and the historical, I think, outlook that the people had then was more like, hey, if I'm going to build a museum, it should be one that the world can look at and get wowed by. Whereas in Pittsburgh, they were like, yeah, we're just going to, this Heinz Center, we're going to build something that's, you know, for the locals. So I thought, like I said, I thought it was kind of cool.
Side note, we just drove by an exit sign. Uh-oh. For a town called Shardlesville.
Yes.
Which is celebrating sharding, apparently. Yeah. So, something we can all...
They are?
I don't know. It's Shardle's
made that up.
It's not true. Many a people have sharded while driving past that exit.
Yeah.
I might have myself. Just now.
I believe the sharding was discussed by Rob when he hosted the show many, many years ago and talked to some guy who had a website called poopreport.com. I couldn't tell you what was in it because I wasn't around for that episode.
That's why we couldn't get that domain. Right. Damn him.
Poop Report. We talked to Poop Report. One time we talked to WrestleCrap.com many, many years ago.
Lots of fecally themed performances.
Yes. Absolutely. That kind of thing. All right, so I will now get into some pop culture, blah, 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 blah. So I don't know if you guys have kept track with Ocean Gate. No?
I don't know what that is.
The Titanic sub.
No.
That new sandwich at Subway?
No. You didn't see the last year, the stupid idiot had the sub that went down to the Titanic and it imploded. Coast Guard looking for it for like a week.
That I heard.
Yeah. And James Cameron was James Cameron was like, we knew immediately it imploded because this guy was an imbecile and built this sub out of carbon fiber, which you never used titanium. Oh, you never. So you haven't seen any of the documentaries?
No.
I would certainly advise. There's one on Netflix, and I think there's another one on HBO Max or whatever they're calling it now.
I saw something about it on Disney Plus, but I didn't watch it.
Oh, they have one too?
I think so. Something with James Cameron and the Titanic, I'm assuming.
No. It's not James Cameron. The company was called Ocean Gate, and they made submersibles. And the last one that they made was called the Titan, with the purpose of this guy that he was going to take it down to... So normally, these deep, deep-sea submersibles that go that far down, you can only fit like one person in it, maybe two, because they're made out of titanium. You know, there's no room in there. And they're exploration vessels, scientific vessels. Sometimes they're naval vessels. The Russians usually build them. And so this guy had this idea, I'm going to build a submersible that can take like a half a dozen people on like a tourist ride down to Titanic, which is like, you know, I don't know how deep it is there, to 20-something thousand feet or whatever it is, or miles, I should say. And so he built this thing, and they all told him, you cannot build this out of carbon fiber, because carbon fiber, you know, it expands, contracts, it has these, you know, microscopic cracks in it, you know, it delaminates. And you can't use it that many times. So this guy did this, and, you know, like I said, it blew up, it imploded on him. But I was watching these documentaries, and it's like, I know, you know, this is like 20, 25 now, and it just seemed like it's an industry where everyone else in the industry for, you know, like 50 years now or whatever, they've all operated under the same sort of, you know, rules and regulations. It's all safety is always the number one factor after all these years, and then all of a sudden it's almost like the rest of culture where they're just like, you know what, you guys did this for, you know, 50 years, you did it this way, nobody ever was killed, you know, going down in one of these things, but you know, who cares, let's just do a fly-by-night outfit. And that's essentially what happened. And like I said, the documentaries are both very compelling because of how stupid this guy was. His name was Stockton Rush. He was the CEO. And just the amount of times that he cut corners and sued people. And I just thought, I don't know, I just thought that they were interesting. It's funny.
What's interesting is we do live in a kind of disruptor culture right now, right? Yes. Where being a disruptor, without kind of giving any thought as to what you're disrupting or the process by which you're disrupting, that is being celebrated now, right? Simply being like disruptor. Historically, disruptor has been a word with a negative connotation, yeah. And now being a disruptor in the modern lexicon is seen as like this good thing. When, you know, let's just take all the old rules and throw them out without really thinking about what the outcome or the sort of thought behind what those old rules were. And I get, you're right, we are seeing that across lots of vectors of our culture. It's a strange thing to think about, that you think you can just simply upend the old way without considering why the old way was put into place and hope for positive outcomes. And what we end up is tiny microscopic chunks of human flesh around in the ocean.
those they were vaporized. But you know what's funny is it kind of leads into like the TikTok culture, where if you go onto TikTok and you look, or Instagram, or whatever, and you look in the videos, it's like nonstop. I mean, there's all kinds of videos, don't get me wrong, but there's so many that are nonstop of like car crashes, plane crashes, some idiot jumping off of a cliff into the water, misses the water, hits the rocks. You know, it's like it's like crazy, you know, just wild, dangerous stuff. And it used to be that you'd only see that in like a cartoon or on like some movie, but now it's at the palm of your hand or right on your thumb, and there it is. And I guess his that guy was sort of that version for the Titanic. There is no video, by the way, of the implosion.
I guess by definition, there probably couldn't be. It's interesting that you say that, because just last night I was doom scrolling on TikTok, and I saw...
Wait, what did you call it?
Doom scrolling.
Oh.
And I saw a video. So the other day, there was a tourist family touring Black Sand Beach in Iceland.
Yeah.
And first of all, if you've never vacationed in Iceland, there are signs. Iceland is an amazing place. Like, it's like visiting the surface of the moon or something like that. But there are signs pretty much everywhere in all the national parks that be careful, there's no one here to protect you, and lots of things are here to kill you. And this family got...
Well, it's a volcano!
More or less. And so on this beach, I was at this beach in 2018. There are signs everywhere: do not get close to the water, you'll be swept away and you will die. And there's a video on TikTok of a family getting swept into the water, and like other people rushed to rescue them, but their 9-year-old daughter just swept away and died. And you watch this video of this kid dying, and it's like insane. You don't even, like, it's real, and you don't even know how to process what you're seeing.
There's no editorializing or editors on TikTok. It's completely wide open.
Yeah.
You know, like back in the day, if you had how would you even do this? But if you had a VHS footage of like a plane crashing or something like that, you know, you would contact the local news, and they would pay you for it, and they would air it. Maybe this would take like 2 weeks, and they would air the footage like in a heavy, doctored, edited way, so it wouldn't like freak people out.
Yeah, it's all unfiltered now. It's just straight up access.
So speaking of, one of the ones I love watching are what they've done now is people will go to like amusement parks, and they will take, I guess they could take GoPros, but now they're probably just their own phone, and they take the phones on all the like crazy rides, the roller coasters, and then they post it and all that kind of stuff. And actually, when we were in Pittsburgh, up in the mountains there, I was thinking about maybe there was a local place that does this. It may even be international, for all I know, because of the insurance reasons. All right, so the first thing is, have you guys ever heard of the Alpine Slide?
No.
Ah.
No.
All right, well.
There was an Alpine roller coaster at Busch Gardens.
No,
Alpine,
not a roller coaster. It's not
Alpine
a roller coaster.
East, I think.
No. So one of the great facets about the old New Jersey deadly amusement park, Action Park.
I watched that documentary.
Yeah, of course. So one of the great rides, I went on this as a little kid, was the Alpine Slide or Skate or whatever. It was around all over the place. But essentially what it was is they would go on like a mountain, on the slope of a mountain or a big hill or whatever. And they would carve out kind of like a little half pipe of concrete. So it was a little like track of concrete. And so the key was that you would get on these Alpine Slide things, which could be like a go-kart shaped thing or like a sled. And the whole thing was you'd get on it, and there was a handlebar, and on the handlebar was a brake. And I don't know what the brake did, but hardly anybody used it. But the whole key was you would go down this path, which would like curve and up and down, all this kind of stuff. It was a track. And the whole point was to stay in the path, because if you didn't, you would go careening off the side of the mountain, bouncing off of rocks, you know, coming out of it and all that. And at Action Park, that would happen often. Of course, it was actually one of the safer rides at Action Park, but that would happen quite a bit. So I always had this great affinity for that ride. And so one of the things I saw was, I don't know where this is, probably all over the place. Very similar thing where they go on the mountain and they out of concrete, they create this like racetrack that you might see in like a Need for Speed game or something. Very curved, all these sharp curves all over the place. And then what they do is the people go on the top and they get into it's essentially a go-kart. There's no engine. You know, I think it has tires. Yeah. I believe. And all it has is a brake. And so
it's like the track on Indiana Jones.
No. Well, it's not. It basically is, but there's no. Cart. Yeah, like a minecart race, but there's no actual track. It's a concrete like mini road. It's just concrete. And so the whole thing, but the key is, so they put the people in these things, and then they put a skateboard helmet on them, and on the top of the helmet is a little holster where you can put your cell phone. So you put your cell phone on video and record the trip all the way down. And on this one that I've been seeing videos of, they put obstacles. And I'm not kidding you now. The obstacles are like wooden posts and like jumps and stuff. I mean, it looks like a video, like a crazy video game. And there's video and these people, it's from like the one person looking at the other person. And you see the person like hit these things and immediately like crash. They go rolling, they're splattered, rolling down the concrete. There goes the cart. And then when there's these hairpin turns, you know, always the first idiot doesn't stop, goes head first, bounces off, causes a crash. I actually want to go on these things.
that's the takeaway, is that you want to go on it.
Well, here's the thing. I would go on it, but I would actually try and win. You know, like I would actually try and punt people and get ahead of them to win, not to die.
It's like Mario Kart, basically.
Well, Mario Kart, sort of. But Mario Kart was not really like you bumped into them. It's more like you're throwing objects at them. You know, it's kind of like a high speed insane bumper cars. But I don't know where these are. I have a feeling that they're in like South America or something like that, where there's kind of like no regulation.
I kind of want to check this out. Unfortunately, since our phones are always listening, it'll probably not be recommended to me.
Yeah, exactly. But your phone, it basically is like a parasite.
That was insane what happened yesterday.
Yeah, we're at the convention and we're talking. What were we talking about?
You mentioned Foreigner.
Right. I was talking about what became of the band Foreigner and that Lou Gramm was back again touring with them. And Mr. Flair here has no interest in Foreigner at all. And you, like, literally 15 seconds later, look at your phone, and there's an ad for Foreigner.
Yes, there was.
Big Brother.
It was really unsettling.
So that was interesting. All right, what else is on the list here? Oh, is anybody going to see the new Naked Gun movie?
No, I don't see movies in the theater anymore.
Probably not. It doesn't look great.
Yeah, it's this weird thing where, like, there was this review buzz that it was great, and then all the people who actually saw it said it was terrible.
I refuse to believe that anyone thought it could possibly be great. I mean, come on.
Liam Neeson, I guess, could be funny, but I just... I can't see. The thing that annoyed me was that the Zucker brothers, who created the Naked Gun and the airplane movies, they actually had a script for a new Naked Gun movie for many years that they were working on. And the studio just, you know, threw them off and did it with somebody else. So that's kind of why I was I have an embargo on it.
That genre, that like sort of...
You don't like it?
Late 80s slapstick, you know, mega irony, very, you know, sort of farcical stuff. That it's just not for me. I never add into the farcical stuff at all, ever.
I could tell you that, especially the Naked Gun first and second Naked Gun movies were part of my like elementary school, junior high lexicon. I mean, we would repeat those jokes and stuff constantly, and just out of the blue. It was sort of like the Major League movie was, you know, there's a million lines from that movie we would repeat all the time, and you know, obviously Pee-wee's Big Adventure and things like that. But that was the because again, even at that age, like we never, you know, there's all this sexual innuendo in the Naked Gun movies, which, you know,
well, I mean, the title, right?
So for the most part, we never got it. Like we never really got it. But we just thought the other jokes were funny, and you know, Leslie Nielsen's delivery of them and George Kennedy, and you know, that it was funny. But I can't see how the new one could be funny at all.
I don't feel like anyone out there was clamoring for a remake of the Naked Gun.
But they're remaking everything.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's some properties out there that maybe there was, you know, some weird, like, morbid curiosity in what it could be like. I've never seen anyone ask for this. So yeah. I won't be checking it out.
Well, speaking of remakes, wait a minute, let me pull this up. I'll show it to you. So what do you think of this? So this has been known that they're going to do a Buffy the Vampire Slayer remake continuation on Hulu, and that Sarah Michelle Gellar is a producer and she's going to be in it,
you
and
know,
blah
Hulu
blah blah.
Is actually being, it was announced yesterday. Hulu is being folded.
Yeah, I heard that.
Into Disney Plus.
Yeah, Hulu is gone as a brand. I'm curious if that impacts any of their properties. I don't know.
Well, I don't know if it's done if it's gone as a brand. It's gone as a standalone app. It may still be a tab within the Disney Plus ecosystem.
I just have the feeling that they will do that because Hulu has all that FX stuff, and it's not like Disney, you know, children, blah blah blah. You know, I mean, they got like Always Sunny and some other stuff like that, and even the Buffy show, I wouldn't think would be for
but
children.
As it is right now, if you have all those services, you can watch Always Sunny through the Disney Plus app. The Hulu stuff is accessible.
Yes.
So I think it'll be like that, but I mean, I don't really know.
So what? Well, what did you think of Ms. Geller? I thought she still looks good.
I guess she's holding on somewhat.
Well, I also saw she put out a training video of her and the girl who is going to play the lead in the show, and I thought that she still looked ready to kick some butt. So, and I was a big Buffy fan, so I don't know. I guess I'm looking forward to it in a sense. You know, see how they make of it. I don't know. You know, one of the people we met at in Pittsburgh was Amy Smart, who I've been a longtime fan of, and her most recent, you know, major role was on the DC CW show Stargirl, which got canceled. And I felt that was as close as you could get to a Buffy show, where you have like a teenage blonde and she's a superhero and the family is involved and it's got her own like Scooby gang and blah blah blah. I guess you guys didn't see that.
No,
I also never saw Buffy for what that's worth.
Same, actually. Same. Yeah, it's one of those things that, like, I know for me at least, any media that came out during a certain time frame, I was kind of blacked out from because I didn't have access to cable when I was in college.
It was on Channel 11.
I didn't have access to TV at all in college. And
you're still in mourning from Hulk losing to the Ultimate Warrior.
We'll get to that.
I didn't have access to TV, and so I just didn't, you know, that was sort of between like 98 and 02, I didn't watch anything, really. And then
were you incarcerated?
No, I just didn't watch anything. If I rented movies, I would go to the movie theater. I would rent movies from the local place. There was no Blockbuster in Baltimore either.
Baltimore.
Yeah. So it was kind of a weird thing, and I had no access to TV, so I just didn't. There's like a black hole in some of my knowledge there.
Mm. Yeah, Buffy, I was always a big fan of. I mean, it's tough to rewatch now because they never really remastered it. Maybe they'll do it now. I don't know. But, you know, the old episodes look terrible.
Well, a lot of the shows from that era, they like partially filmed and then they did effects on video. Yeah. And you really can't you do too much with it. It's like you kind of shot.
I think they could with that. It's just the problem is that the rights have always been a problem with that show because, I mean, they're still paying this husband and wife team who produced the original movie that Joss Whedon wrote. I forget who directed it. With Christy Swanson. It was 30-some-odd years ago, and they're still basically getting, you know, anything that Buffy does or Angel or anything that comes out of it, they get this big check.
And, you know, whenever there's, like, a rights thing like that, it changes the game for how future projects get produced.
Yes. So now, it is the great segment of the Pawn Stevenson Show for many years, which was celebrity deaths. So there's been a lot of them, actually, that I'm going to go through here before the big ones. The first one, I don't have Rob here to do his Cosby, but Malcolm Jamal Warner, Theo, he croaked. Unfortunately, died and drowned in the Pacific Ocean, Costa Rica. Thoughts?
Okay. Dana, you go first.
I mean, I definitely wouldn't have predicted that Theo from the Cosby Show would have died at sea like that.
At sea?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's sad. It's tragic, I suppose. I never met him, which sucks, but oh well.
Well, not at the Jeremiah. Yeah. He was very upset about that. Never got him!
You know, I thought that the response to his death was a little bit strange because, like, he had his moment, right? The Cosby Show was mammoth in its day. Then he just never did anything after that of meaning, I guess, of import.
He had some guest spot. He was actually on an episode of Sliders one time.
I used to catch Sliders once in a while.
You better have.
But anyway... But he was when he died, it was this weird reaction where people were like, "Oh, this is a momentous thing. He's this cultural icon." I thought he was very young. I was like surprised at how young he actually was. I always perceived him as being older than that. But I thought that the reaction to his death was a little bit disproportionate, especially what was to come shortly thereafter. But it is sad. But I mean, it's not like I don't think. I think the Cosby Show, paved the way for a lot of things, but I don't think the rewatchability is particularly high. I don't think anyone goes back like, "Oh, I gotta go catch, binge old episodes of Cosby." It's not like that. But
Rudy, do you want your Jell-O gelatin?
But I do think it paved the way for sure. It's a very important show in television history.
I mean, I think part of it not having rewatchability is because it's not really syndicated. Because Cosby is a rapist, they
took it away.
But I mean, beyond, I think if he wasn't the complete creep, I think it probably would have a little more of a place on like a Netflix, and would have more of a following. I think it's a solid show. Still, I mean, I haven't watched it in years, but it was always a fun Nick at Night, property.
You know, I actually wasn't a big Cosby Show fan back in the day. Believe it or not, I was more of an Alf guy, and.
Racist.
What? You don't know what race Alf is. Well, actually, what it was from Melmac, right?
Exactly.
Oh! I kill me! Alright, and then the other one, I don't know if it's related, but... I guess in terms of sitcoms, earlier this year, Bob Uecker, Mr. Baseball, died. So I have to mention the Uke. He was, he starred on Mr. Belvedere for a while. And also in the movie Major League and 2 and 3. But when I was growing up, Uecker was known, so we used to joke if we were at a stadium or something with like bad seats, we would call it the Uecker seats. Because Bob Uecker it was in his commercials, they would, Miller Lite commercials, and he would always be sitting at like the very top of the upper deck and, things like that. But he's actually. The other thing he was known for is a wrestling name, wasn't he?
He did a lot of Mania appearances. Yeah, that's how I knew who he was, honestly.
Mr. Baseball, he was at the think WrestleMania 4, maybe, I don't know if he did 5. He was definitely at 4 at in Atlantic City, which, you know, misnomer people have is they think that that WrestleMania was at Trump Tower, Atlantic City, which no longer exists. It wasn't. It was actually at the convention center, but that Trump actually sponsored it and referred to it as Trump Tower, but it really was, it actually wasn't there. So if you actually want to see the site of WrestleMania's 4 and 5, you can go to Atlantic City. It's still there. It's still the old convention center.
Mania 4 is best left forgotten.
Really?
Oh, it's the worst one. That's, there are others that are worse.
WrestleMania 2 is probably the worst one.
But Mania 4 is up there for being bad. Long and bad. Oof.
Hmm. Was that the one where Hogan... Was that the tag team match?
4 was the tournament.
The tournament.
Yeah. Oh, the tournament. And then Macho Man won it, right?
Right, well, but Hulk and Andre did the double disqualification with the horrible-looking chair shots. And as soon as they did that, you knew it was shenanigans the rest of the time.
Well, I didn't know that as a, what year was that? About a 9-year-old.
Yeah, that was 88, so.
Oh, was it? All right, I was closer to, no, I was still like 9, 10.
I was 1.
There you go.
But back to Bob Uecker, he's one of those celebrities that I was sure he was already dead.
What?
Yeah.
He was still the lead radio announcer for the Milwaukee Brewers. But that's where he was from.
I was sure. When they said he died, I'm like, again?
You know, the first ever autobiography I ever read was Bob Uecker, who wrote a book called The Catcher in the Rye. Get it? Catcher. He was a catcher. And so, it was part serious autobiography, and then the rest of it was just clearly complete farcical nonsense about his baseball career, and just it was clear like he was, you know, making up jokes and things like that. I was always a big fan of Bob Uecker. I have an autograph through the mail from him many years ago. Also,
I'm always impressed with people who are able to have a career and then parlay that into something else where they turn out to be better at that other thing. You know, I mean, you could argue that...
Well, he wasn't much of a baseball player.
Right, that's what I mean. But he parlayed that and his, you know, his status into this media career where he achieved moderate success and he was a well-known personality. He was good at it. He was a funny guy. That's always impressive to me when someone's able to do that. It's interesting.
Dana, weren't you watching baseball in the 90s?
Yeah.
But he was the color commentator with Bob Costas on NBC.
I didn't think he was dead that long, but I thought he died around, like, COVID.
I forgot. I thought you said you knew who he was. You thought he was dead.
No, someone else must have died that I just sort of mixed up in, you know, the years that followed.
Plenty of people died.
Yeah.
All right, and some more
people do. They're really good at it.
Yeah. So, also, from my childhood, if you will, the reruns, Jay North. The actor who played Dennis the Menace back in the early 60s, or maybe it was the 50s. Now, he was a Nickelodeon staple. You know, after school, you'd come home and flip it around, and there's the black and white Dennis the Menace show. Jay North and Mr. Wilson. Well, the first Mr. Wilson. The second Mr. Wilson was not as funny. I'll get to that in a second. But Jay North, unfortunately, passed away. And the funny thing about the Wilsons was, I think the first actor who was very, very funny, I don't know if he had a heart attack or something like that, or a stroke, and he couldn't act, or, you know, he was off the show, and so they had to replace him. So they replaced him with this other guy who lived in the house, but he lived in the house with Mr. Wilson's wife, which is ridiculous, and they said he was his brother. So... And, like, this is the great thing about old-school sitcoms, American sitcoms, is that you can have a situation where, these two adults and the husband goes away, you know, kayfabe, he goes away, and the brother comes in, takes his place with the wife, and no one bats an eye.
It's very biblical, really. This is the story of Onan, right?
Did you watch Dennis the Menace?
I was very big into it as a teenager.
What?
I was a Nick at Night fiend as a teenager. I used to watch Mr. Ed and Dennis the Menace. Those two in particular. I actually, I'm going to take a page out of Dana's book. I thought Jane North had been dead a really long time. I never gave it a second thought. I really liked Dennis the Menace as a kid. I thought he had great comic time. He was a really funny actor. And it was a really funny show.
Hey, Mr. Wilson!
Yeah, he's a great child actor. I really enjoyed it. That makes me sad. I missed this one.
Yeah. I mean, I used to catch the reruns. I'm younger. This is one of the few times I can feel young. And I always think of the Walter Matthau, Mr. Wilson, as well. But I mean, I of course saw the original.
But Christopher Lloyd.
I remember Christopher. I haven't seen that since I was so little. I didn't know who Christopher Lloyd was when I last watched that.
I had the great so. Back in that
on I-78 East in half a mile.
Oh, we got a hazard.
Still on the fastest route.
Not the Dukes of Hazzard. Yeah, so back in the early 90s, we family, we actually went to the movies together quite a bit, like at night here and there. And one of the movies I remember us seeing was the Dennis the Menace movie, which came out in, I don't know, probably 93 or 94 or something like that. And it was appallingly bad. Couldn't make it. And that was at the time when they were remaking everything from the 60s into movies. And while, you know, I think it came later, but like the Brady Bunch movie was really funny. But a lot of them were,
upcoming traffic ahead due to a hazard.
Macaulay Culkin did the Richie Rich movie, which was awful. And,
That's how we got Mission Impossible.
Right.
Which was actually great, a great franchise.
Yes. Well, yeah, but I mean, the kids' movies they were remaking far more often. But ironically, the same chiller, the last one that Jay North did, they had the guy from Richie Rich. What was his name? He was in Overboard, Goldie Hawn. And The Lost Boys. Remember that tall guy? He used to do, like, History Channel voiceovers. He would narrate all the History Channel shows. I can't think of this man's name.
I'm definitely the wrong person to ask for this.
It was Edward Herman. Anyway, he was also at that chiller, but I didn't get him, stupidly.
So Jane North had done chiller?
Oh, many times.
I was an ignoramus back then because I never thought. I regret that now, not even realizing he was there. That's upsetting.
Well, you missed Dennis.
I blame you.
Jay North did conventions regularly for quite a while, and he appeared with the woman who played the girlfriend on Dennis the Menace show. Yes.
Yeah.
He'd do the Hollywood show a lot and some other nostalgia conventions in general. But I remember reading that he had a lot of physical problems and a lot of health problems, and that's why he basically retired. And he was in pretty poor health for years, and passed away, unfortunately. And also, from my childhood, Lynn Marie Stewart died. She was Miss Yvonne from Pee-wee's Playhouse. And then later on, she played Charlie's mom on It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and was terrific on that show. I find her much more fondly from Always Sunny than even Pee-wee's Playhouse. And then she did the Broadway run of Pee-wee's Playhouse. And again, like an idiot, I didn't go and get her. I went by the Pee-wee's Playhouse Broadway show once when Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman, came out with the megaphone and, like, thanked everybody for coming and then went back in and left. So if Lynn Marie Stewart came out, I don't think she came out of that door. I think they probably came out a different door. I don't know what the deal was, but I don't even remember seeing her. And she was one of those people who did chiller, like, the time before, or maybe like the year before that Rob and I started to go. So I never got her. She never did another East Coast convention. really, or at least Northeast. Any Pee Wee fans here?
I was not allowed to watch Pee Wee's Playhouse.
Really?
Yeah, my parents thought it was too weird. I'm not kidding. And so I was not allowed. They were. All right. So when I was like, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We lived in Brooklyn on a street that didn't have cable at all yet.
Yeah.
They hadn't laid the cable yet. And then we moved to Long Island.
When but it was on Channel 2.
I don't know. I don't.
Saturday
I don't remember.
Mornings.
Yeah, I don't know. And then, so I don't know. I don't. My TV consumption, I guess, didn't go in that direction. I remember not being allowed to watch it.
Now,
and, you know, they policed my TV back then.
Oh, that's fine. Now, Dana, I don't know if you would have seen Pee-wee because when he had his issue in Sarasota, Florida. Or was it Clearwater? Anyway.
Brother.
Now, which issue are you talking about?
The movie theater issue.
Okay.
They threw him off the air, which would have been like it was like 1991.
I definitely saw Pee-wee in some capacity. I don't remember.
It was the movie.
Maybe it was the movies. I definitely watched Pee-wee as a kid. But honestly, my recollection of Pee-wee is Pee-wee. I don't really remember much of the supporting characters. It's just Pee-wee is my like memory.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, they had S. Epatha Murkison. She was the male lady. They had Cowboy Curtis, played by Lawrence Fishburne, known as Larry at the time. And they had the king of cartoons was this I can't think of his name, but he was Blackula. He was like famous at that point for these, you know, the black exploitation movies back in the 70s. And they had him on that show. And they also had the sailor guy, Carl, was played by Phil Hartman. So, yeah, that was a good old Pee-wee's Playhouse. I guess it's you still find the book, The Inside Pee-wee's Playhouse, written by our old friend of the show, Cassine Gaines, who was on our show many times. And he wrote that book, Inside Pee-wee's Playhouse. He also has a Inside the Christmas Story and Back to the Future. Not a lot of those books. But, yeah, Lynn Marie Stewart, that stunk. And then some music deaths. Brian Wilson died. He was the founder and, the musical genius of the Beach Boys. I was always a big fan of. And he passed away. And, of course, his daughters were in Wilson Phillips. And I saw Brian. I paid for the very expensive meet and greet many years ago in Newark, the NJ Pack.
Was it really very expensive by today's standards? Or just, you know, by...
Well, I mean, it was expensive in the sense that it wasn't that bad when they first started doing it because he was signing outside items. You know, your personal items. And then when I went to do it, they had stopped that.
Isn't that always the way?
Yep.
Of course. So...
Roadwork reported ahead on I-78 East.
Oh, we don't care about this roadwork.
You're still on the fastest.
Why are they doing roadwork on a Sunday?
I don't think work is being performed. I just think there's signs.
People are afraid of the signs.
Yeah.
So, Brian Wilson, of course, head of the Beach Boys. Yeah, I went to that. It was cool. They had him, Al Jardine... And Blondie Chaplin, who was with the Beach Boys in the 70s.
So that wasn't the one with Mike Love?
That no.
Because they did a meet and greet with both of them together.
Well, they did. Bottoms. Yes. So they, none of them ever did meet and greets. And then they did the 50th anniversary. And this is the one I should have went to. But this is back in, I think it was 2012 maybe. It was the 50th. And they did a tour. And it was basically, it was all the original Beach Boys. I think it was 2012, and maybe later, I don't know. So the original Beach Boys that were still alive, there was like five of them. And yes, they did the meet and greet, and they had you get the photo with all five of them or whatever at the same time, which is a great photo. And then when that tour ended, they also put out a record, and it had some decent songs on it. And when that tour ended, then Mike Love went back to touring on his own as the, quote, Beach Boys with Bruce Johnston and a bunch of the others. And, in fact, he took a bunch of the guys, including the late Jeff Foskett, over from Brian Wilson's band. And then they kept touring with them. And then Brian went back on tour with Al Jardine and Blondie Chaplin and Billy Hinchy, who's also dead, and some others from that had worked, you know, played with them in the past. So, yeah, so what I wound up doing was I paid for a meet and greet upgrade with the Mike Love band, and we got Mike Love and Bruce Johnston. And, of course, that was a time that John Stamos was supposed to be playing drums that night and wasn't there. You know, found out, like, the day before he wasn't doing that show. And then the other one was Brian Wilson. So, yeah, I had to do it. I had to pay separately. But those were two or three or four or whatever years after the 50th, you know, of the band. Any Beach Boy thoughts? Anybody?
I mean, I was shocked at how little public sort of chatter there was about the death of Brian Wilson. That, to me, that's like an end of an era.
Yeah.
You know, this is someone who's widely regarded as a very, very important musical genius of his era, incredibly influential musician. And there was some stuff, but I mean, especially because, I mean, the Beach Boys, I think, have a devoted, pretty loyal army of fans. And I was a little bit surprised at how muted the response was. And I'm not really sure why. I mean, I'm not a huge Beach Boys fan, but is my interpretation off or
I'm not sure, but one thing I will say is every major musician of the last whatever posted a photo of them and Brian Wilson. And in a way that I had personally never seen before in the age of social media, how many people of these people not only had met Brian Wilson, but they had gone out of their way, almost like we would. We pay for a lot of these things, but sometimes we don't. Sometimes, you know, it's a free meet, or it's not even a sanctioned meet, and we get in, or we try and get them somehow, or whatever. But it just seemed like so many of these musicians from all kinds of genres went out of their way to get to meet Brian Wilson, you know, going backstage at a show or something like that, that didn't even work with him, but they were just huge fans. And almost every single one of them, when they posted their photo, they like posted like we would, like they posted a report of, oh, you know, this was 1988 and I was doing this and I was doing that. And you know, this guy I knew, my friend of mine got me to see Brian Wilson and let me tell you about how it was. And it was, I've never seen that before. There is another one we'll get to, but I've never seen that before with a celebrity like that, where these people were like recounting these stories about how important he was to them as musicians.
You think I'm gonna make a claim here? Do you think that like he was the musician's favorite musician?
Oh, absolutely.
In the way that Norm Macdonald was the comedian's favorite comedian.
I would say, yeah. The difference with Norm is that Norm was never like big.
No, he wasn't. But he was the comedian's favorite. Every comedian says Norm is a different comedian, right? Yeah. So that's kind of what threw into my head. But I was expecting like newspaper retrospectives and da 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 da, because Mike Love, I mean, not, Brian Wilson is so instrumental in like
But do they honestly do they do that for? They do that. Well, we're gonna get to the people that
they did it for Michael Jackson.
Yeah, but that's Michael Jackson.
The Beach Boys are pretty damn close to Michael Jackson.
That's ignorant, as Rob would say.
No, I really think the Beach Boys are pretty damn close.
I think the issue is a lot of the Beach Boy fans are dead.
No.
Oh, come on. They're like my parents' age. They're in their late 60s, early 70s.
Well, Michael Jackson also died. He was like 50 years old.
I guess. And he was... The elderly changes the calculator. It does.
And he... I mean, his heyday was much closer in terms of recent memory. I mean, let's face it, the Beach Boys, they had a decent kind of second life in the 80s.
Yeah, Kokomo.
With Kokomo and the Full House stuff and all, but Brian Wilson wasn't even in the band, really. He would show up, but wasn't doing anything. But, I think you're probably right about that, but I just don't think that they do it for celebrities much at all anymore. In this age, it's just, and I think one of the reasons is that when these people die, there is this immediate, like, outpouring on social media, and it just sucks all of the interest and the energy out. And so then all of the more, you know, the more generic kind of media sources are like, well, you know, what are we going to say about this guy?
Also, if it's not a tragic death, there's less of a...
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if someone's older and we're sickly and stuff, it's hard to get all worked up about it, you know. Harder to get worked up about it, I guess.
Yeah, another one was, I don't know if you know who this guy is, but his composer named Mark Snow. He passed away. He did a lot of television work, but he wrote the X-Files theme and a lot of the music from the X-Files and the show Millennium and all that. And I actually met him at an X-Files convention outside of Chicago, and he was very nice. But yeah, I don't have his full filmography in front of me, but he did a lot of TV shows. He did some movie work also. But I'm trying to think. There are television composers who have done great work on theme songs in particular and that people remember. But, I mean, like, you would never really think about the music in the show as being as important to the show as the X-Files. You know, all that weird kind of music that would play in the episodes and stuff was, like, part of the motif of it. And so, yeah, it's just...
No, it is interesting. Actually, it's interesting how the music of TV shows and the commercial aspects of that have changed over the years, right? So historically, very, very famous people and very, very accomplished people wrote jingles for TV and songs for TV, and they were paid basically nothing. They were paid for session work, and that was that. And then sometime in the 90s, that changed a little bit, and these composers for TV would start getting residuals for it, you know? So do you know if he was on a residual deal for them, or?
No idea. Well, I mean, I would think because, you know, this happened started in 93.
Well, it's funny because you bring up Buffy, right?
I did.
And so, do you know who wrote the theme song for Buffy?
I forget.
It's the only reason I know that, it's like a weird piece of trivia. It's a band called Nerf Herder.
Oh, right, Nerf Herder.
So Nerf Herder was this very, very nominally successful,
right,
you know, sort of punk rock group.
Yeah.
And they were very, very niche. I was a huge Nerf Herder fan, that's how I was. And very, very niche stuff. Really never broke through mainstream. I don't even think it was Joss Whedon. I'm not really sure. Somebody in the production pipeline was a Nerf Herder fan.
Right.
They commissioned Nerf Herder to write that theme song. And those guys just decided, we're going to coast the rest of our careers on the money from this show. And this way they would record. And they released albums and they recorded. And they did whatever they wanted because they had money. But that was also true of They Might Be Giants from Malcolm in the Middle theme music and stuff. Where these bands... later on in the mid to late 90s and early 2000s and even to today, they are able to basically, you know, earn a living from writing for TV. And a lot of composers and writers and musicians from the period before that got ripped off, and that their work was used in perpetuity and they got paid for nothing. That's in one area where streaming has benefited, and DVD had benefited a lot of musicians as well.
Yeah,
and it's just an interesting... weird.
And then the last one musically was from Rob and I's hometown Belleville. Connie Francis croaked finally. Well, not finally, but she died. Of course, she had a massive career in the 50s and into the 60s. And used to see her quite a bit when I was a kid. She would come to the Italian American feasts that they had in town. She was there like every year, and I didn't, never realized, really kind of who it was. But yeah, she passed away, unfortunately. And
what's funny about her? Funny may be the wrong word. I don't know. But we were talking about TikTok before.
Yes,
One of her songs recently charted again because
two of the
TikTok.
Songs.
Yeah, we live in a very strange timeline where songs that haven't been, publicly really even acknowledged for decades, all of a sudden reemerge and become financially successful and fruitful again, and push people into the spotlight who had more or less receded forever. And it was it's just interesting how she passed right when she sort of reemerged into the public eye.
Right, and actually, she, you know, she knew about those songs, so that was, I think it was a good...
I saw her interviewed about it, yeah.
Yeah, so that was unfortunate. All right, and then, I guess the big ones, and I know you guys covered it on your show a few times, but the Hulkster, Hulk Hogan, dead! What happened?
One too many leg drops. No, I'm serious. He was in shambles.
Take your vitamins, brother.
He was in shambles, unfortunately, and he went and he had this neck fusion surgery. And I guess, you know, the medical machine in this country killed him.
Well, he died of a heart attack.
I mean, after being bedridden in hospice care.
Well, we don't know. That's, you know, only a wrestling icon like Hulk Hogan in the world of wrestling could be surrounded, his own death by natural causes could be surrounded by so much mystery, because as he is probably lying, you know, even if they didn't think he was dying, obviously he was, like, you know, he had Jimmy Hart and some other people, I think it's one of the Killer Bees, right?
Ryan Blair.
Yeah, Ryan Blair. Saying like, oh, no, the Hulkster's great. Hulkster's great, buddy. Hulkster's doing fine. We just had karaoke with him, brother.
Yeah, I mean, it shows you how psychotic and ill the wrestling business is, that these guys were kayfabing down to the end. When this guy's lying in his bed, Jimmy Hart was talking about how Hulk was doing karaoke, and other people were reporting Hulk hadn't spoken in a month. He couldn't speak anymore.
Well, which is it?
I mean, it's obviously here's the truth. Like, there's one of the things that's so beautiful and awful about that business is that it's all fake, it's all a lie. And you're even when you want to believe something's true, these guys will lie to the end, seemingly for no reason. They lie for the sake of it, you know, to protect information they think is worth protecting. The whole thing is bonkers, you know. I mean, it's. What's amazing about a lot of these guys is not that they die, it's that they've lived as long as they had. I mean, 71 is not an old age, but when you see how he destroyed himself with drugs and with physical abuse and with multiple surgeries, and he was still working a full schedule, traveling all over the country, and it's sort of a miracle that he didn't die sooner. But Hulk is a weird one, in that the guy... who transcended wrestling. He was ubiquitous. Everyone knew Hulk Hogan. He had a ridiculous Q rating. Everyone knew him. He's internationally known. Weird things historically. His right guard commercials were famous.
Yes! No one mentioned that, but those are great.
Oh, man. A sublime poet of odoriferous emanation. Odoriferous emanation. His ridiculous TV shows, his horrible movies, his stupid pasta restaurant. There's so many weird things that he was a part of, and he had this look. He's one of those people who you could take a physical feature of his body, right, his arm or his mustache, and it's instantly recognizable in a way that is so interesting and so unique. And again, they don't make characters like that anymore.
So Rob is not in the car with us, but his joke on Hogan always was, he'd always say, can you believe that Hulk, when we were kids, Hulk Hogan was like 30 years old? he looked like he was like 55 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the physique was good, but I mean...
He broke in his 20s, and he looked old. He was bald. And it didn't matter. It worked. It just worked. It did.
So, who remembers the Hulk Hogan grill? Am I the only one
that... Hulk Hogan grill?
Yeah.
Well, there was a George Foreman grill. George Foreman also died.
Yeah, there was recently. A Hulk Hogan grill, and I mean, of course, as Hulk Hogan tells it, that his grill was supposed to be the Foreman grill, but there was some little misstep and miscalculation.
Oh, right.
But there was a Hogan grill, which I think I actually chucked a few years ago.
Well, he had also the Hulk Hogan Vitamix thing, the blender. He had all kinds of products.
Well, I mean, they all do. You know, when they're that ubiquitous, they can make all that stuff. But I had some things that happened. Well, here's the thing about Hogan that I always found interesting was, you know, in terms of, you know, you don't have pro wrestling in the way it is now, or it has been for all these years, 35, almost 40 years now. Oh, yeah, 40 years, Hulkamania.
Wait, Hulkamania really started in 83.
Did it?
Yeah. 83, in the AWA was Hulkamania.
Oh, right. Yeah, but I mean, like, merchandise-wise, it was like 85. Because that's when you had the Topps cards came out that year. We all had those Topps cards. I mean, most of them were in the bicycles, but... we had the Topps cards.
I had the Hulk Hogan Halloween costume.
Yeah.
The horrible Halloween costume. I had the Hulk Hogan sheets on my bed. I had everything you could have. A Hulk Hogan lunchbox. Everything that could be bought, I had of Hulk Hogan.
So I don't know if
underwear,
I had underwear. Oh, dear.
He's still wearing them.
I don't think Sean saw this. I showed it to Dana, but I was looking through my stuff, and I still, the two artifacts that I kept somehow after all these years, 40 years, is I got in the, it had to be the first grade, could have been second grade, but you know, back then you would have there was like a book club thing where, you know, in your elementary school they would come in and they would there was a Scholastic did this for a while, there's some other companies, but basically they would come in with like little kiddie books and you could buy them, you know, to have or whatever. And so I had this little mini WWF sticker book where Hulk Hogan's on the cover, and I kept that in like pristine shape, and I said I always wanted to get it signed but never got around to do it, and I kept forgetting. And then the other thing I kept was, and I didn't even, here's the crazy part, I've had this little thing, this little figure for probably 40 years, and it's all beat up and missing paint. When I looked at it, you know, the few weeks ago, I realized what it was from, and it never hit me where this thing came from. It was a rock and wrestling toy. It was a little, it was an eraser, technically.
Those are pretty valuable.
Well, in the package. I mean, mine's mangled. But those are the only things, and I think I got that in the second grade, and probably both things. And those are the things that I kept, you know, all those years. But the fun thing about Hogan is what I always thought was, what are we looking at? Rest area?
Yeah, half a mile.
Yeah. What I always thought was amazing about Hogan was he was the first... Now, there were others. I always felt he was the first big-time wrestler who, like, knew how to be, like, truly a world champion, where everywhere he went, you know, was this big... I mean, he'd show up to the WWF matches in, like, a limousine... And he'd always be separate from everybody else because he was viewed as this, you know, this massive champion. What are we doing here? Oh, I don't know if this is not an actual rest area. This is just a truck stop thing.
It's mislabeled as a rest area.
Yeah, well, I guess it's rest for the trucks.
Yeah.
So, brother. Say your prayers, brother. All right, so Hogan.
Hogan, in a lot of ways, I think, can be compared to Arnold.
Yes.
In the sense that they both understood
steroids.
They both understood that they needed to both be taken seriously, but also inject humor into everything. So whenever you watch Hulk, you know, Hulk had no media training.
Right.
And almost in 85, 84, 85, 86, he gets thrust into the media spotlight in a very similar way to Arnold in the late 70s. And when you watch those appearances and the way he conducted himself, there was always that wink and a nudge and not taking himself entirely seriously, but also then he would puff out his chest and be big and serious. And he had that way of carrying himself that people got a kick out of it. It wasn't like, you know, you look at the wrestlers of the past, like a Bruno or whatever, where the Bruno had, you know, a certain amount of appeal, but Bruno took himself too seriously. You couldn't shake the wrestling weirdness of it.
Yeah.
And Hulk didn't do that. He allowed himself. He allowed himself to be accessible to normal people.
Hogan was kind of like the Muhammad Ali of wrestling, in the sense that he was this great champion, but he was also an entertainer and a showman. And there were other. That was wrestling. But those guys, you know, he took his act somewhat from superstar Billy Graham, but those guys, especially you mentioned Bruno and like Bockwinkel and all those people, Bob Backlund was so boring, and he was the champion for a while, you know, for instance. But like, you're right. I mean, those guys, they took themselves seriously, and, you know, to the point of it was like, it's so funny about that, because when I look at wrestling today, And, you know, I mostly, if I watch wrestling, it's AEW. And the faces, it's hard to call someone a face in AEW or heel because they pretty much all are at the same time. And they're kind of like this, they're kind of old school in the sense that their kayfabe is that they're looking to fight somebody, you know, and there's going to be an actual fight. We're going to have a fight. We're going to, you know, you burn my house down, we're going to have a fight. You hit my wife, we're going to have a fight. And when Hogan, sometimes that would happen, but normally it was like his matches, because he didn't, that was the other thing, is Hogan didn't do like house shows and things like that. He was just mainly a pay-per-view act. And then when he was with WCW, he was almost entirely that. But with Hogan, it was like when he wrestled somebody, he was wrestling them for like his life, for like the world was at stake.
Some abstract concept of justice or something.
Yeah,
like that.
You know, it was always like he was basically, if you talk about a real life superhero, that was him. That was the character of the Hulkster. Was he was a, you know, a real life superhero in the sense that he would tell the kids, you know, go to bed and eat your vitamins and all this nonsense and whatever. But everything that when he fought, it was not a fight. It was a battle or a wrestling match. But that there were some these you know, higher end stakes involved. And that, well, I guess you can't do that anymore in wrestling because no one will take it seriously, which is, you know, of course, an oxymoron.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't compare, you know, Cody Rhodes nowadays is finishing stories where you had Hulk Hogan, you know, defending us against, you know, Hussein and Slaughter and all these evil people. And it was just a different thing. I mean, and in a way it was a little more, I guess, cartoonish. It was over the top in a way that wrestling almost tries not to be today.
Did you guys hear that? Apparently, this is, I didn't even know this, but I don't look at it that seriously. But Bischoff said on a recent podcast with that Huckster guy, does the podcast, Conrad, whatever his name is. The what does he sell again?
The mortgage guy.
Yes. Yeah. So Bischoff said that at one point Hogan during his big run WWF. And actually had approached Vince and asked for a percentage of the WWF because he felt like he was so huge and that he would sign a contract where he would get these, you know, he'd get a percentage and basically be the lifetime face of the promotion. And obviously that didn't happen.
That sounds like the kind of story that Hulk would tell, but that wasn't necessarily true. It's also, with Bischoff, you can never believe anything he says either. That's also something that I think Hulk probably internalized and believed. But like anything else, you know, one of the Hulk's great shortcomings was that he adapted his act precisely once, right?
Yes.
With Hollywood, but never was able to really adapt again. And that's why he kind of, you know, eventually everything gets old and tastes change and, you know, opinions shift. We might be living in a very different world had they gone with that, you know, but they couldn't really go with that because Hulk also represented an era of rampant, unchecked drug use and other sorts of behaviors that, you know, you can keep quiet in the 80s, but you couldn't anymore. In the 90s and beyond, and so you know, there was really no way to make Hulk the public face permanently. It could never have happened.
Yeah, I think like honestly, at that point with the trial, being able to distance themselves from Hulk, or at least like you know when he came back and he was like a fraction of the size. If they would have been like just shackled to him.
By the way, he also lost that weight to do the television stuff.
Oh yeah.
You know, I mean, at least that's what they said, that they asked him to slim to Thunder in Paradise. So they asked him to slim down because they were like dude, you're ridiculous at this point.
Yeah, when you looked at him in 91 into 92, he was gigantic.
Yeah, I mean, listen, Thunder in Paradise wouldn't have been able to pull down those, like, 2.4 IMDb ratings if Hulk was a little beefier.
The funny thing is, Thunder in Paradise was not a failure. It was a moderate success.
Yeah, I loved it as a kid. I enjoyed it.
It was stupid.
But, I mean, I think it could have worked with Hulk being larger. I don't think Hulk being svelte was, like, necessary.
Well, I think the issue you get into there is if he's so big, right, then it's almost like if he's going against bad guys, he's basically, you're always expecting him to, like bare-knuckle brawl with them.
It's the Superman conundrum, right? Who can beat Superman? No one. So there's no threat. There's no danger. Right. You know, that's why Superman always needs, like, people around him who are vulnerable. It's the same concept, you know, how no one can touch Hulk. So he needs a kid or a woman next to him that they can, you know, go after. If he's that big, it's not credible. So, I don't know. Either way, there was just no way for him to continue forward. And in fact, one of the things Kevin Nash talks about a lot in interviews is that even when they were doing NWO stuff, like Hall and Nash had to constantly coach Hogan and tamp his ridiculousness down because he was acting like it was 85 and they had to kind of like steer him, and that I believe because Nash is a huckster as well.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, he's also a very bright guy, and I believe that.
Right, but also, you know, he'll tell you that whole character, that Hollywood character, was Hogan's creation, and that, you know,
sure, that's
him. Yeah, that's you know, and he thought of the idea. I used to be red and yellow, brother. I'm gonna wear my biker stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, Hogan actually. He did a trial run of that black gear in WCW, you know, when he was semi feuding with Sting, and he ended up teaming with Sting. Then he did a trial run, briefly, wearing the black, and so they floated it. There were signs, you know, but big picture, you know, Hulk is one of those people who everyone knows who he is.
Right.
He has entered the cultural consciousness. And it's that's fascinating.
I mean, I always say to people, Dana missed this largely, but when I was a kid, Hulk Hogan was everywhere. I mean, there were other big movies. Obviously, Star Wars was huge a little bit before then, you know, things like that. You know, and there was Transformers were huge at the time. And
Gremlins 2. Gremlins 2, they hired Hulk to do an insert cameo into Gremlins 2. But he was so ubiquitous, it was just, it was what it was. It was expected almost. Yeah. It's crazy.
Oh, they ever want to see Snow White and Seven Dwarfs. Yeah, that's funny. But, but it's like, anywhere you went was Hulk Hogan in some way. Like, you go to, like, any store, there was a Hulk Hogan something, a Hulk Hogan this, a Hulk Hogan that, and he was almost like a spotlight. If you were a kid and you in that era and you were walking around and you saw like a Transformers whatever, something that looked like a Transformer, it was like you were like a dog, like dog hearing like a whistle. What? Transformers? You know, what? Hulk Hogan? I mean, it was everywhere. And then, yeah, I guess, like, Ninja Turtles did that after that era to an extent. But, you know, the guy was everywhere. And, you know, and I always tell the story about my younger cousin. They had a birthday party at his house. And he was insane about wrestling. And I think he was only, like, 4 or 5. And they had a Hulk Hogan impersonator show up. And this is the other thing is, and this could only happen in the 80s, that there were impersonators that would show up, and there wasn't like you could, it wasn't like somebody would show up in a Barney suit and be a Barney impersonator. I mean, give me a break. But to show up as Hulk Hogan, not He-Man, okay, which was huge then, or, you know, whatever, but as Hulk Hogan. And this guy, like, acted the part. Like, he sounded like him. He was a really tall guy, blonde hair. And I think what he wound up doing was they took Polaroids. He picked all the kids up from our ankles and held us upside down And they took Polaroids, and can you believe I lost my picture?
That's devastating.
Years ago, and I was asking my cousin the other day, and he said, yeah, I don't think I have one either. He's like, I think my mom has it on video somewhere. But I, knowing them, God knows, they moved so many times, they probably lost it. But that would have been something great to have. But, I mean, I can't think of another, like, not a comic book character, but a real person, more or less, to have a kid's impersonator. Like, again, you wouldn't have had, even though they were huge, you wouldn't have had a Stallone Rocky impersonator show up, okay? Or, I don't know who else, but the fact that it was Hogan was just how huge he was then.
From 85 to 89, he was the biggest star in the world among young men. It's not even a question. Just huge in every way. And again, you saw him everywhere. Everywhere.
All right. And then the other big death was in the world of music was Ozzy Osbourne, which I know you guys talked about. But so the funny thing about, and Hulk Hogan, this happened as well, by the way. You look on Instagram, every celebrity apparently has met Hulk Hogan. They all had pictures with Hulk Hogan going all the way back, including when they were kids and they weren't even celebrities. And then Ozzy Osbourne, the amount of people, musicians, and again, not like contemporaries or people that were, you know, big, you know, Metallica, obviously, they loved Ozzy Osbourne, or people that were, they were growing up in music, but musicians who were still alive, who were older than Ozzy Osbourne, and on the scene before him, that posted all these, like page-long statements that you wouldn't even imagine that they even knew who the guy was. You know, he had this great effect on people. And I watched some of his the videos of the funeral procession in Birmingham, and you know, it was very sad. But I'm just thinking, you know, of Ozzy. You know, he's known as the reality show guy for a number of generations, also. And yeah, I don't know. I'm just thinking, like, he was a big deal definitely in the UK and amongst people here. And, you know, he definitely got press coverage. But I would just go back and I would say, like you were talking about Brian Wilson, if Ozzy Osbourne had not done that MTV show, and he dies today, or he dies this year, there's not going to be anywhere near the coverage.
No, the MTV show gave him a second wind for quite a
while. He had new life from that.
Yeah, And it's funny because there were reality shows before him. You know, I was the first generation that watched them when they did the Real World, for instance, on MTV, which of course was an actual kind of, you know, semi-documentary reality show where the people that they had on these Real Worlds were not like losers. They were actually people that when they auditioned to get on that show, they auditioned and they were picked because they were ambitious and because they were looking to be successful, right? And that's kind of why it was almost like a Shark Tank for young people back then. And then it became, you know, a hellhole.
Well, Ozzy's show came about in the era of like the Growing Up Gotti show, where it was all the
Hogan had a show too.
He did. He was post Ozzy as well though. Right. Like, but it was all that junk TV fake.
Yeah,
scripted,
it was totally fake.
You know, really, like, really voyeuristic, kind of gross stuff. And, you know, but the thing was, what came through about Ozzy, and I'm gonna be honest, I was not a viewer of that show, but from the limited things that I saw, he came through as kind of lovable.
Well, yeah.
Which made, because Ozzy's whole aura and mystique was that he was a lunatic. That was his whole, for a really long time, he was a lunatic. I mean, the infamous
The bat,
right? That was the legend about Ozzy. Was he bit the head off a bat on stage, and that was like,
and he pissed on the Alamo.
Yeah, crazy things. And what you really saw was he was just kind of this lovable guy, and he was a little bit quirky. But
Sharon, I lost my shoes, Sharon.
Right, but this very kind of lovable guy, and that's the imprint on our our cultural consciousness was that lovability. So he was like this demonic sort of presentation, but the reality was, oh, we really know the truth. But he's this very lovable guy. And that's how people view him. And I think people have this affection for him in a very, very unique way.
No comment?
I didn't watch the show. I didn't listen to the music. I'm not, I agree that, I was a lot more aware of Ozzy from the little clips you'd see in the commercials from the reality show.
I'll be honest. So I didn't listen to Ozzy when I was younger. It's not really my genre. But I remember when, I had friends who were into it because they were metal fans. And, North Jersey, a lot of metal fans. And I remember when they had the Ozfest stuff, late 90s, early 2000s. And I was, and so I remember the Ozfest. And in fact, it was the one Ozfest was the one in Giant Stadium where they tore out the seats and caused all kinds of mischief. But I remember when that was happening and I would say to these people, I was like, you're going to see Ozzy? Like, he's still a thing? But yeah, he was still enormous and... Black Sabbath.
It's actually important. Ozfest did, in other ways, breathe life into him. Where he was scouting these bands that were, and he was showcasing, using his name to showcase these bands to the world. That was another branch of it.
Right, of course. Yeah, that was a good old Ozzy. And then let's see. Finally, this is not a death. This is not a death. Supposedly, they're canceling Howard Stern. Finally. From Sirius. Sharon, are you still listening to that bum?
I stopped. I actually canceled my Sirius subscription. Not for any reason other than I just didn't want to pay for it anymore. I used it as a commuting thing, and I moved significantly closer to work, and so I was listening to the show for 10 minutes a day, and you catch reruns and whatever. It just wasn't worth it anymore.
Well, I had the same experience. I was more, again, I'm more of an ONA fan, but...
Listen, I have tremendous affection for Howard. I love Howard. I think, his contributions... Well, I think his contributions to media, to discourse, will really only be recognized long into the future. I don't think we really fully grasped how much he has done over his career to change how we communicate. I still think the show, up until, I canceled it a year or two ago, it was still funny, just different kind of funny, but still funny. There were so many times over the years where I almost drove my car off the road. I was laughing so hard at something I was listening to. The truth of the matter is, what's happening to Howard is what happens to all of us, right? He's a 71-year-old man. He should have been off the air 5 years ago.
I know, but they just keep paying him.
Well, sure, right? And it's one of those great, if you're in that position, it's one of those great challenges. It's why politicians never retire. If people are going to continue to throw money and power and influence at you, it takes an extraordinary amount of self-discipline to say no, to hang it up and be done. It's my understanding that he doesn't work Fridays and he doesn't work over the summer. But after that show, after that news broke that he's being canceled, he did a live show on Friday to dispute that rumor. I don't know. I didn't listen to it, obviously. But we were driving.
It's not a rumor. The band has barely worked in years on that, particularly since COVID, and even before then, he's barely worked. I mean, and now after COVID, he left New York. I think he lives in L.A. And he just does the show on remote.
I thought it was Florida, but
I thought it was L.A. now, but initially Florida, but I think L.A. Anyway, he does it remote. He's not in the studio with anyone ever anymore. I just think that's absurd.
Yeah, I mean, look at his. He always had what I always loved about Howard was he had his pulse. He had his finger on the pulse of what people would think was interesting, and he was able to, even when it didn't go the way he thought, he was able to extract something interesting. And for the past couple of years, he only presents things that he finds interesting. And, not for nothing, I don't care about, Neil Young or John Stamos or whatever. I just don't. And I think most of the audience doesn't either. And he flogs these things that he finds interesting, and he lost his ability, and I think the way that most of us do when we're in our 60s and 70s, you lose your ability to connect with the wider culture. That's just how life is. I remember he was offered an opportunity years ago to do like a show that was an interview specials, like Oprah, where he would just do like four or five a year, where he would do four or five big interviews and that's it, and ditch the show, and he decided against it. I think it was the biggest mistake he could have made, because at least then he could pick and choose and make things relevant.
Originally he was on America's Got Talent, wasn't he?
And then horrible. It was horrible.
Oh, he was bad?
The show was bad. He was bad. It was like one of those gross... Oh, incidentally, I have a friend who was a producer on that show who was able to get me like third row seats. And so I was able to meet... Ryan Seacrest, Howard, the whole crew. I couldn't get any photo ops or anything, but I met them all backstage. And I actually have a screen grab of myself in the audience. I'm really close. But, like, I just was there because I wanted to be near Howard, you know? But it was... I watched the show. It was awful. He was just awful. The whole thing was awful. It betrays all of the stuff that made Howard great, you know?
Well, I never understood about Stern. And, again, I being an Opie and Anthony fan, I was always on their side in their battles. And, the problem was, like, when they became big in New York, Howard hated them. He's very insecure. And they'd have these battles. But what I never understood about Stern was, because, when I was a kid and when I had a car and all that, I would listen to Imus in the morning. Believe it or not, I don't know why. I was at the Imus. And then in the afternoons, I would listen to Mike and the Mad Dog on WFAN, and eventually Opie and Anthony and all that. I'd go back and forth. But what I never understood was I loved Stern's E! Show. I watched that constantly. I thought it was fantastic. And it was huge. It was like the biggest show on E! It was one of the biggest cable shows. And he just stopped doing it.
So there's a story behind that. E! Did not pay for that show.
Ah.
Howard used that as a vehicle to drive traffic and energy towards his brand. And then when it came, and he was hoping to do it for free and make it so big they would have to pay. And then when it came time to renew, he had no budget. E was at the time an independent, it hadn't yet, now E is part of another much larger corporation.
Well, actually, they just got rid of it.
It had been purchased by like Paramount or one of the, I forget which one. But yeah. So it was owned by one of the big conglomerates, but it wasn't back then. They had no budget, they couldn't pay him. So then he said, I'm not doing this. It was the same situation with the Channel 9 show where they couldn't pay him.
Well, that show stunk.
But yeah, I mean, that was before my time. I was a kid. But I loved the E! Show also. They didn't pay for it. And so, you know, yeah, I think he was always someone to never take any nonsense. So he would walk away from a deal if it wasn't to his satisfaction. And like, people always accused him of like selling out and things like that, but I don't know. As someone who's labor forward, I guess I'm very in favor of being paid for your work and being fairly compensated, because a lot of people made money off of Howard on E, and not Howard.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm surprised that he didn't then try and shop it somewhere else and have it get picked up. But I don't know. I guess. I mean, that's even a show where you could look at it and say, you know, was there enough content today to put it on? And I would say yes. I mean, I think he had enough of, you know, interviews and stupid. The problem, I think it was only a half hour show anyway. But I think one of the issues you had was, I don't think people really wanted to see like the radio stuff. You know, where he's taking a call or something like that. I think it had to be, somebody had to physically be there. Whether it was obviously the Whack Packers were a big draw for that show. Celebrities.
The E! Show in the era of Richard and Sal, it would be unbelievable. I mean, they ended up doing like Howard TV and Howard on Demand through cable. And that was moderately successful. But then on the whole, you know, cable bottomed out. There was no more on demand because everything went to streaming, and they were never able to figure out how to remonetize it. It wouldn't surprise me if at some point that content was packaged and sold to some entity that was able to stream it and make money off of it. But Howard's also very weird about the way his stuff is sold. He's never allowed merchandise ever, 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 except for those VHS tapes in the 80s, which he talks about even today, how he regrets doing it. He's never allowed any, his guys are never allowed to tour on his name. He's never done any, he just refuses to allow any merchandising. But you know how things go. It's the same thing happened with J.D. Salinger when he died and his son got, yeah, got. Eventually, someone's going to get a hold of that, you know, IP, and they're going to make money off of it. That's just how the world works. And so I'm very curious where that content and intellectual property ends up.
All right. Well, on that note, I don't know when we'll talk to you next. It's up to Mr. Rob. But again, thank you guys for being here on this journey into, I don't know where we are. Well, we're back in New Jersey, actually.
We are. We're back.
Yeah, I know where we are. So until next time, folks, toodaloo. My back is killing me.
Where the hell's the rest of stuff?
Yeah, we're not on the turnpike.
I mean, at this point.
Are we? Well, no, we never know the turnpike.
Do you know what it's time for?
It's time for...
Well, the old jingle of the episode.
It's such a good feeling to know you're alive. It's such a happy feeling. You're growing inside, and when you wake up ready to say, I think I'll make a snappy new day. It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that I'll be back when the day is new. And I'll have more ideas for you, and you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will too.